This is Audible.
Death by Drowning and Other Stories by Agatha Christie. The Herb of Death. Mrs. Bantry looked around her dinner table at her guests. Miss Marple wore black lace mittens, and an old lace fichu was draped round her shoulders. Sir Henry Clithering, ex-commissioner of Scotland Yard, had suggested inviting Miss Marple after telling how the white-haired old lady outdid everyone in the game of crime-solving. Mrs. Bantry's gaze fixed on her broad-shouldered husband as he sat talking to Jane Hillier, the beautiful and popular actress. And there was also the elderly Dr. Lloyd. Sir Henry interrupted her thoughts. "Now then, Mrs. B," he said. Mrs. Bantry looked at him in cold reproof. "I've told you before that I will not be called Mrs. B. It's not dignified. Scheherazade, then. And even less am I what's her name? I never can tell a story properly. Well, ask Arthur if you don't believe me." "You're quite good at the facts, Dolly," said Colonel Bantry, "but poor at the embroidery." "That's just it," said Mrs. Bantry. She flapped the bulb catalogue she was holding on the table in front of her. "I've been listening to you all, and I don't know how you do it. He said, she said, you wondered, they thought, everyone implied. Well, I just couldn't, and here it is. And besides, I don't know anything to tell a story about." "We can't believe that, Mrs. Bantry," said Dr. Lloyd. He shook his grey head in mocking disbelief. Old Miss Marple said in her gentle voice, "Surely, dear." Mrs. Bantry continued obstinately to shake her head. "You don't know how banal my life is, what with the servants and the difficulties of getting scullery maids, and just going to town for clothes and dentists and Ascot, which Arthur hates. And then the garden." "Ah," said Dr. Lloyd, "the garden. We all know where your heart lies, Mrs. Bantry." "Must be nice to have a garden," said Jane Hillier, the beautiful young actress. "That is, if you haven't got to dig or to get your hands messed up. I'm ever so fond of flowers." "The garden," said Sir Henry. "Can't we take that as a starting point? Come, Mrs. B, the poisoned bulb, the deadly daffodils, the herb of death." "Now it's odd your saying that," said Mrs. Bantry. "You've just reminded me. Arthur, do you remember that business at Clodderham Court? You know, old Sir Ambrose Bursey. Do you remember what a curtly, charming old man we thought him?" "Oh, why, of course, yes, that was a strange business. Go ahead, Dolly." "Well, you'd better tell it, dear." "Nonsense, go ahead. Must paddle your own canoe. I did my bit just now." Mrs. Bantry drew a deep breath. She clasped her hands, and her face registered complete mental anguish. She spoke rapidly and fluently. "Well, there's really not much to tell. The herb of death, that's what put it into my head, though in my own mind I called it sage and onions." "Sage and onions?" asked Dr. Lloyd. Mrs. Bantry nodded. "That was how it happened, you see," she explained. "We were staying, Arthur and I, with Sir Ambrose Bursey at Clodderham Court, and one day, by mistake, though very stupidly, I've always thought, a lot of foxglove's leaves were picked with the sage. The ducks for dinner that night were stuffed with it, and everyone was very ill, and one poor girl, Sir Ambrose Ward, died of it." She stopped. "Dear, dear," said Miss Marple, "how very tragic. Wasn't it?" "Well," said Sir Henry, "what next?" "There isn't any next," said Mrs. Bantry, "that's all." Everyone gasped. Though warned beforehand, they had not expected quite such brevity as this. "But my dear lady," remonstrated Sir Henry, "it can't be all. What you've related is a tragic occurrence, but not in any sense of the word a problem." "Well, of course there's some more," said Mrs. Bantry, "but if I were to tell you, you'd know what it was." She looked defiantly round the assembly and said plaintively, "I told you I couldn't dress things up and make it sound properly like a story ought to do." "Aha," said Sir Henry. He sat up in his chair and adjusted an eyeglass. "Really, you know, Scheherazade, this is most refreshing. Our ingenuity is challenged. I'm not so sure you haven't done it on purpose, to stimulate our curiosity. A few brisk rounds of 20 questions is indicated, I think. Miss Marple, will you begin?" "I'd like to know something about the cook," said Miss Marple. "She must have been a very stupid woman. or else very inexperienced. She was just very stupid, said Mrs. Bantry. She cried a great deal afterwards, and said the leaves had been picked and brought into her as sage. And how was she to know? Not one who thought for herself, said Miss Marple. Probably an elderly woman, and I dare say a very good cook. Oh, excellent, said Mrs. Bantry. Your turn, Miss Hellyer, said Sir Henry. Oh, you mean to ask a question? There was a pause while Jane pondered. Finally, she said helplessly, Really? I don't know what to ask. Her beautiful eyes looked appealingly at Sir Henry. Why not the cast, Miss Hellyer? He suggested, smiling. Jane still looked puzzled. Characters in order of their appearance, said Sir Henry gently. Oh, yes, said Jane, that's a good idea. Mrs. Bantry began briskly to tick people off on her fingers. Sir Ambrose, Sylvia Keane, that's the girl who died. A friend of hers was staying there, Maud Y, one of those dark, ugly girls who managed to make an effect somehow. I never know how they do it. Then there was a Mr. Curl who had come down to discuss books with Sir Ambrose, you know, rare books, queer old things in Latin, all musty parchment. There was Jerry Lorimer. He was a kind of next-door neighbour. His place, Fairleys, joined Sir Ambrose's estate. And there was Mrs. Carpenter, one of those middle-aged pussies who all seemed to manage to dig themselves in comfortably somewhere. She was by way of being a dame de compagnie to Sylvia, I suppose. If it's my turn, said Sir Henry, I suppose it is, as I'm sitting next to Miss Hellyer, I want a good deal. I want a short verbal portrait, please, Mrs. Bantry, of all the foregoing. Oh, Mrs. Bantry hesitated. Sir Ambrose now, continued Sir Henry, start with him. What was he like? Oh, he was a very distinguished-looking old man, and not so really very old, not more than 60, I suppose, but he was very delicate. He had a weak heart. He could never go upstairs, and he had to have a lift put in, so that made him seem older than he was. Very charming manners. Courtly, that's the word that describes him best. You never saw him ruffled or upset. He had beautiful white hair and a particularly charming voice. Good, said Sir Henry. I see Sir Ambrose. Now, the girl Sylvia, what did you say her name was? Sylvia Keane. She was pretty, really very pretty. Fair-haired, you know, and a lovely skin. Not perhaps very clever, in fact rather stupid. Oh, come, Dolly, protested her husband. Arthur, of course, wouldn't think so, said Mrs. Bantry dryly, but she was stupid. She really never said anything worth listening to. One of the most graceful creatures I ever saw, said Colonel Bantry warmly. See her playing tennis. Charming, simply charming, and she was full of fun. Most amusing little thing, and such a pretty way with her. I bet the young fellows all thought so. That's just where you're wrong, said Mrs. Bantry. Youth, as such, has no charms for young men nowadays. It's only old duffers like you, Arthur, who sit maundering on about young girls. Being young's no good, said Jane. You've got to have S.A. What, said Miss Marple, is S.A.? Sex appeal, said Jane. Ah, yes, said Miss Marple, what in my day they used to call having the come hither in your eye. Not a bad description, said Sir Henry. The dame de compagnie you described, I think, as a pussy, Mrs. Bantry. I didn't mean a cat, you know, said Mrs. Bantry. It's quite different. Just a big, soft, white, purry person. Always very sweet. That's what Adelaide Carpenter was like. What sort of aged woman? Oh, I should say 40-ish. She'd been there some time, ever since Sylvia was 11, I believe. Very tactful person, one of these widows left in unfortunate circumstances, with plenty of aristocratic relations, but no ready cash. I didn't like her myself, but then I never do like people with very long white hands, and I don't like pussies. Mr. Curl? Oh, one of those elderly stooping men. There are so many of them about, you'd hardly know one from the other. He showed enthusiasm when talking about his musty books, but not at any other time. I don't think Sir Ambrose knew him very well. And Jerry next door? A really charming boy. He was engaged to Sylvia. That's what made it so sad. Now, I wonder, began Miss Marple, and then stopped. What? Nothing, dear. Sir Henry looked at the old lady curiously. Then he said thoughtfully, So this young couple were engaged. Had they been engaged long? About a year. Sir Ambrose had opposed the engagement on the plea that Sylvia was too young, but after a year's engagement he'd given in, and the marriage was to have taken place quite soon. Ah, had the young lady any property? Next to nothing. Bare 100 or 200 a year. No rat in that hole, Clithering, said Colonel Bantry, and laughed. It's the doctor's turn to ask a question, said Sir Henry. I stand down. My curiosity is mainly professional, said Dr. Lloyd. I should like to know what medical evidence was given at the inquest, that is, if our hostess remembers, or indeed if she knows. I know roughly, said Mrs. Bantry. Was poisoning by digitalis. Is that right? Dr. Lloyd nodded. The active principle of the foxglove, digitalis, acts on the heart. Indeed, it's a very valuable drug in some forms of heart trouble. Very curious case altogether. I would never have believed that eating a preparation of foxglove leaves could possibly result fatally. These ideas of eating poisonous leaves and berries are very much exaggerated. Very few people realize that the vital principle, or alkaloid, has to be extracted with much care and preparation. Mrs. MacArthur sent some special bulbs round to Mrs. Toomey the other day, said Miss Marple, and Mrs. Toomey's cook mistook them for onions, and all the Toomeys were very ill indeed. But they didn't die of it, said Dr. Lloyd. No, they didn't die of it, admitted Miss Marple. A girl I knew died of ptomaine poisoning, said Jane Hellyer. We must get on with investigating the crime, said Sir Henry. Crime, said Jane, startled. I thought it was an accident. If it were an accident, said Sir Henry gently, I do not think Mrs. Bantry would have told us this story. No, as I read it, this was an accident only in appearance. Behind it is something more sinister. I remember a case. Various guests in a house party were chatting after dinner. The walls were adorned with all kinds of old-fashioned weapons. Entirely as a joke, one of the party seized an ancient horse pistol and pointed it at another man, pretending to fire it. The pistol was loaded and went off, killing the man. We had to ascertain in that case, first, who had secretly prepared and loaded the pistol, and secondly, who had so led and directed the conversation that that final bit of horseplay resulted. For the man who had fired the pistol was entirely innocent. Seems to me we have much the same problem here. Those digitalis leaves were deliberately mixed with the sage, knowing what the result would be. Since we exonerate the cook, we do exonerate the cook, don't we? The question arises, who picked the leaves and delivered them to the kitchen? That's easily answered, said Mrs. Bantry, at least that last part of it is. It was Sylvia herself who took the leaves into the kitchen. It was part of her daily job to gather things like salad or herbs, bunches of young carrots, all that sort of thing that gardeners never pick right. They hate giving you anything young and tender. They wait for them to be fine specimens. Sylvia and Mrs. Carpenter used to see to a lot of these things themselves, and there was foxglove actually growing all amongst the sage in one corner, so the mistake was quite natural. But did Sylvia actually pick them herself? That nobody ever knew. It was assumed so. Assumptions, said Sir Henry, are dangerous things. But I do know that Mrs. Carpenter didn't pick them, said Mrs. Bantry, because, as it happened, she was walking with me on the terrace that morning. We went out there after breakfast. It was unusually nice and warm for early spring. Sylvia went alone down into the garden. But later I saw her walking arm in arm with Maud Wye. So they were great friends, were they? Asked Miss Marple. Yes, said Mrs. Bantry. She seemed as though about to say something, but didn't do so. Had she been staying there long? Asked Miss Marple. About a fortnight, said Mrs. Bantry. There was a note of trouble in her voice. You didn't like Miss Wye, suggested Sir Henry. Well, I did. That's just it. I did. The trouble in her voice had grown to distress. You're keeping something back, Mrs. Bantry, said Sir Henry accusingly. I wondered just now, said Miss Marple, but I didn't like to go on. When did you wonder? When you said that the young people were engaged, you said that that was what made it so sad. But if you know what I mean, your voice didn't sound right when you said it. Not convincing, you know. "What a dreadful person you are," said Mrs. Bantry. "You always seem to know." "Yes, I was thinking of something, but I don't really know whether I ought to say it or not." "You must say it," said Sir Henry. "Whatever your scruples, it mustn't be kept back." "Well, it was just this," said Mrs. Bantry. "One evening, in fact, the very evening before the tragedy, I happened to go out on the terrace before dinner. The window in the drawing room was open, and as it chanced, I saw Jerry Lorimer and Maud Wye. He was, kissing her. Of course, I didn't know whether it was just a sort of chance affair or whether one can't tell. I knew Sir Ambrose never had really liked Jerry Lorimer, so perhaps he knew he was that kind of young man. But one thing I am sure of, that girl Maud Wye was really fond of him. You'd only to see her looking at him when she was off guard. And I think, too, that they were really better suited than he and Sylvia were. I'm going to ask a question quickly before Miss Marple can, said Sir Henry. I want to know whether, after the tragedy, Jerry Lorimer married Maud Wye. Yes, said Mrs. Bantry, he did, 6 months afterwards. Oh, Scheherazade, Scheherazade, said Sir Henry, to think of the way you told us this story at first. Bare bones indeed, and to think of the amount of flesh we're finding on them now. Don't speak so girlishly, said Mrs. Bantry, and don't use the word flesh. Vegetarians always do. They say, I never eat flesh, in a way that puts you right off your nice little beefsteak. Mr. Curl was a vegetarian. He used to eat some peculiar stuff that looked like bran for breakfast. Those elderly stooping men with beards are often faddy. They have patent kinds of underwear, too. What on earth, Dolly, said her husband, do you know about Mr. Curl's underwear? Nothing, said Mrs. Bantry with dignity. I was just making a guess. I'll amend my former statement, said Sir Henry. I'll say instead that the cast of characters in your problem is very interesting. I'm beginning to see them all. Eh, Miss Marple? Human nature is always interesting, Sir Henry, and it's curious to see how certain types always tend to act in exactly the same way. Two women and a man, said Sir Henry. The old eternal human triangle is at the base of our problem here. I rather fancy it is. Dr. Lloyd cleared his throat. I've been thinking, he said rather diffidently. Do you say, Mrs. Bantry, that you yourself were ill? Was I not? So was Arthur, so was everyone. That's just it. Everyone, said the doctor. You see what I mean? In Sir Henry's story, which he told us just now, one man shot another. He didn't have to shoot the whole roomful. I don't understand, said Jane. Who shot who? I'm saying that whoever planned this thing went about it very curiously, either with a blind belief in chance or else with an absolutely reckless disregard for human life. I can hardly believe there is a man capable of deliberately poisoning 8 people with the object of removing one amongst them. I see your point, said Sir Henry thoughtfully. I confess I ought to have thought of that. And mightn't he have poisoned himself too? Asked Jane. Was anyone absent from dinner that night? Asked Miss Marple. Mrs. Bantry shook her head. Everyone was there. Except Mr. Lorimer, I suppose, my dear. He wasn't staying in the house, was he? No, but he was dining there that evening, said Mrs. Bantry. Oh, said Miss Marple in a changed voice. Oh, that makes all the difference in the world. She frowned vexedly to herself. I've been very stupid, she murmured, very stupid indeed. I confess your point worries me, Lloyd, said Sir Henry. How ensure that the girl, and the girl only, should get a fatal dose? You can't, said the doctor. That brings me to the point I'm going to make. Supposing the girl was not the intended victim after all. What? In all cases of food poisoning, the result is very uncertain. Several people shared a dish. What happens? One or two are slightly ill, 2 more, say, are seriously indisposed. One dies. That's the way of it. There's no certainty anywhere. But there are cases where another factor might enter in. Digitalin is a drug that acts directly on the heart. As I've told you, it's prescribed in certain cases. Now, there was one person in that house who suffered from a heart complaint. Suppose he was the victim selected. What would not be fatal to the rest would be fatal to him, or so the murderer might reasonably suppose. That the thing turned out differently is only proof of what I was saying just now, the uncertainty and unreliability of the effect of drugs on human beings. Sir Ambrose, said Sir Henry, you think he was the person aimed at? Yes, yes, and the girl's death was a mistake. Who got his money after he was dead? Asked Jane. A very sound question, Miss Hellyer. One of the first we always ask in my late profession, said Sir Henry. Sir Ambrose had a son, said Mrs. Bantry slowly. He'd quarrelled with him many years previously. The boy was wild, I believe, still it was not in Sir Ambrose's power to disinherit him. Clotherham Court was entailed. Martin Bursey succeeded to the title and estate. There was, however, a good deal of other property that Sir Ambrose could leave as he chose, and that he left to his ward Sylvia. I know this because Sir Ambrose died less than a year after the events I'm telling you of, and he had not troubled to make a new will after Sylvia's death. I think the money went to the Crown. Or perhaps it was to his son as next of kin. I don't really remember. So it was only to the interest of a son who wasn't there, and the girl who died herself to make away with him, said Sir Henry thoughtfully. That doesn't seem very promising. Didn't the other woman get anything? Asked Jane, the one Mrs. Bantry calls the pussy woman. She wasn't mentioned in the will, said Mrs. Bantry. Miss Marple, you're not listening, said Sir Henry. You're somewhere far away. Well, I was thinking of old Mr. Badger, the chemist, said Miss Marple. He had a very young housekeeper, young enough to be not only his daughter, but his granddaughter. Not a word to anyone, and his family, a lot of nephews and nieces, full of expectations. And when he died, would you believe it, he'd been secretly married to her for 2 years. Of course, Mr. Badger was a chemist and a very rude, common old man as well. Sir Ambrose Bursey was a very courtly gentleman, so Mrs. Bantley says, but for all that, human nature is much the same everywhere. There was a pause. Sir Henry looked very hard at Miss Marple, who looked back at him with gently quizzical blue eyes. Jane Hellyer broke the silence. Was this Mrs. Carpenter good-looking? She asked. Yes, in a very quiet way, nothing startling. She had a very sympathetic voice, said Colonel Bantry. Purring, that's what I called it, said Mrs. Bantry, purring. You'll be called a cat yourself one of these days, Dolly. I like being a cat in my home circle, said Mrs. Bantry. I don't much like women anyway, and you know it. I like men and flowers. Excellent taste, said Sir Henry, especially putting men first. That was tact, said Mrs. Bantry. Well, now, what about my little problem? I've been quite fair, I think. Arthur, don't you think I've been fair? Yes, my dear, I don't think there'll be any inquiry into the running by the stewards of the Jockey Club. First boy, said Mrs. Bantry, pointing a finger at Sir Henry. I'm going to be long-winded, because, you see, I haven't really got any feeling of certainty about the matter. First, Sir Ambrose, well, he wouldn't take such an original method of committing suicide, and on the other hand, he certainly had nothing to gain by the death of his ward. Exit Sir Ambrose. Mr. Curl, no motive for the death of girl? If Sir Ambrose was intended victim, he might possibly have purloined a rare manuscript or two that no one else would miss. Very thin, most unlikely. So I think that in spite of Mrs. Bantry's suspicions as to his underclothing, Mr. Curl is cleared. Miss Y. Motive for death of Sir Ambrose? None. Motive for death of Sylvia? Pretty strong. She wanted Sylvia's young man, and wanted him rather badly, from Mrs. Bantry's account. She was with Sylvia that morning in the garden, so had opportunity to pick leaves. No, we can't dismiss Miss Y so easily. Young Lorimer? He's got a motive in either case. If he gets rid of his sweetheart, he can marry the other girl. Still, seems a bit drastic to kill her. What's a broken engagement in these days? If Sir Ambrose dies, he will marry a rich girl instead of a poor one. That might be important or not. Depends on his financial position. If I find that his estate was heavily mortgaged, and that Mrs. Bantry deliberately withheld the fact from us, I shall claim a foul. Now, Mrs. Carpenter, you know I've suspicions of Mrs. Carpenter. Those white hands, for one thing, and her excellent alibi at the time the herbs were picked. I always distrust alibis. And I've got another reason for suspecting her, which I shall keep to myself. Still, on the whole, if I've got to plump, I shall plump for Miss Maud. Why? Because there's more evidence against her than anyone else. Next boy, said Mrs. Bantry, and pointing at Dr. Lloyd. I think you're wrong, Slithering, in sticking to the theory that the girl's death was meant. I'm convinced that the murderer intended to do away with Sir Ambrose. I don't think that young Lorimer had the necessary knowledge. I'm inclined to believe that Mrs. Carpenter was the guilty party. She'd been a long time with the family, and knew all about the state of Sir Ambrose's health, and could easily arrange for this girl Sylvia, who, you said yourself, was rather stupid, to pick the right leaves. Motive, I confess, I don't see, but I hazard the guess that Sir Ambrose had at one time made a will at which she was mentioned. That's the best I can do. Mrs. Bantry's pointing finger went on to Jane Hillier. I don't know what to say, said Jane, except this. Why shouldn't the girl herself have done it? She took the leaves into the kitchen, after all. And you say Sir Ambrose had been sticking out against her marriage. If he died, she'd get the money and be able to marry at once. She'd know just as much about Sir Ambrose's health as Mrs. Carpenter would. Mrs. Bantry's finger came slowly round Miss Marple. Now then, schoolmarm, she said. Sir Henry has put it all very clearly indeed, said Miss Marple, and Dr. Lloyd was so right in what he said, but between them they seem to have made things so very clear. Only I don't think Dr. Lloyd quite realised one aspect of what he said. You see, not being Sir Ambrose's medical adviser, he couldn't know just what kind of heart trouble Sir Ambrose had, could he? I don't quite see what you mean, Miss Marple, said Dr. Lloyd. Well, you're assuming, aren't you, that Sir Ambrose had the kind of heart the digitalian would affect adversely. But there's nothing to prove that so. It might be just the other way about. The other way about? Yes, you did say that it was often prescribed for heart trouble. Even then, Miss Marple, I don't see what that leads to. Well, it would mean that he would have digitalin in his possession quite naturally, without having to account for it. What I'm trying to say, I always express myself so badly, is this. Supposing you wanted to poison anyone with a fatal dose of digitalis, wouldn't the simplest and easiest way be to arrange for everyone to be poisoned, actually, by digitalin leaves? It wouldn't be fatal in anyone else's case, of course, but no one would be surprised at one victim because, as Dr. Lloyd said, these things are so uncertain. No one would be likely to ask whether the girl had actually had a fatal dose of infusion of digitalis or something of that kind. He might have put it in a cocktail or in her coffee or even made her drink it quite simply as a tonic. You mean Sir Ambrose poisoned his ward, the charming girl whom he loved? That's just it, said Miss Marple, like Mr. Badger and his young housekeeper. Don't tell me it's absurd for a man of 60 to fall in love with a girl of 20. It happens every day, and I dare say with an old autocrat like Sir Ambrose it might take him queerly. These things become a madness sometimes. He couldn't bear the thought of her getting married, did his best to oppose it, and failed. His mad jealousy became so great that he preferred killing her to letting her go to young Lorimer. He must have thought of it some time beforehand, because that foxglove seed would have to be sown among the sage. He'd pick it himself when the time came and send into the kitchen with it. Oh, it's horrible to think of, but I suppose we must take as merciful a view of it as we can. Gentlemen of that age are sometimes very peculiar indeed where young girls are concerned. Our last organist... Oh, but there, I mustn't talk scandal. Mrs. Bantry, said Sir Henry... Is this so? Mrs. Bantry nodded. Yes, I had no idea of it. Never dreamt of the thing being anything but an accident. Then after Sir Ambrose's death, I got a letter. He'd left directions to send it to me. He told me the truth in it. I don't know why, but he and I always got on very well together. In the momentary silence, she seemed to feel an unspoken criticism and went on hastily. Well, you think I'm betraying a confidence, but that isn't so. I've changed all the names. He wasn't really called Sir Ambrose Bursey. Didn't you see how Arthur stared stupidly when I said that name to him? He didn't understand at first. I've changed everything. It's like they say in magazines and in the beginning of books. All the characters in this story are purely fictitious. You'll never know who they really are. The affair at the bungalow. I've thought of something, said Jane Hillier. Her beautiful face was lit up with the confident smile of a child expecting approbation. It was a smile such as moved audiences nightly in London, and which had made the fortunes of photographers. It happened, she went on carefully, to a friend of mine. Everyone made encouraging but slightly hypocritical noises. Colonel Bantry, Mrs. Bantry, Sir Henry Clithering, Dr. Lloyd, and old Miss Marple were one and all convinced that Jane's friend was Jane herself. She would have been quite incapable of remembering or taking an interest in anything affecting anyone else. My friend, went on Jane, I won't mention her name, was an actress, a very well-known actress. No one expressed surprise. Sir Henry Clithering thought to himself, now I wonder how many sentences it'll be before she forgets to keep up the fiction and says I instead of she. My friend was on tour in the provinces. This was a year or two ago. I suppose I better not give the name of the place. It was a riverside town, not very far from London. I'll call it... She paused, her brows perplexed in thought. The invention of even a simple name appeared to be too much for her. Sir Henry came to the rescue. Shall we call it Riverbury? He suggested gravely. Oh, yes, that would do splendidly. Riverbury, I'll remember that. Well, as I say, my friend was at Riverbury with her company, and a very curious thing happened. She puckered her brows again. It's very difficult, she said plaintively, to say just what you want. One gets things mixed up and tells the wrong thing first. You're doing it beautifully, said Dr. Lloyd encouragingly. Go on. Well, this curious thing happened. My friend was sent forward to the police station, and she went. It seemed there had been a burglary at a riverside bungalow, and they'd arrested a young man, and he told a very odd story, and so they sent for her. She'd never been to a police station before, but they were very nice to her. Very nice indeed. They would be, I'm sure, said Sir Henry. The sergeant, I think it was a sergeant, or it may have been an inspector, gave her a chair and explained things, and of course I saw at once that it was some mistake. Ah, thought Sir Henry, aye, here we are, I thought as much. My friend said so, continued Jane, serenely unconscious of her self-betrayal. She explained that she'd been rehearsing with her understudy at the hotel, and that she'd never even heard of this Mr. Faulkner, and the sergeant said, Miss Hel... She stopped and flushed. Miss Hellman, suggested Sir Henry with a twinkle. Oh, yes, yes, that would do, thank you. He said, well, Miss Hellman, I felt it must be some mistake, knowing that you were stopping at the Bridge Hotel. And he said, would I have any objection to confronting? Or was it being confronted? I can't remember. Doesn't matter, said Sir Henry reassuringly. Anyway, with the young man. So I said, of course not. And they brought him in and said, this is Miss Hellier. And... Oh, Jane broke off, open-mouthed. Never mind, my dear, said Miss Marple consolingly. We were bound to guess, you know. And you haven't given us the name of the place or anything that really matters. Well, said Jane, I did mean to tell it as though it happened to someone else, but it is difficult, isn't it? I mean, one forgets so. Everyone assured her that it was very difficult. And soothed and reassured, she went on with her slightly involved narrative. He was a nice-looking man. Quite a nice-looking man, young, with reddish hair, and his mouth just opened when he saw me, and the sergeant said, "Is this the lady?" And he said, "No, indeed it isn't. What an ass I've been!" And I smiled at him and said it didn't matter. "I can picture the scene," said Sir Henry. Jane Hillier frowned. "Let me see. How had I better go on?" "Supposing you tell us what it was all about, dear," said Miss Marple, so mildly that no one could suspect her of irony. "I mean, what the young man's mistake was, and about the burglary." "Oh, yes," said Jane. "Well, you see, this young man, Leslie Faulkner, his name was, had written a play. He'd written several plays, as a matter of fact, though none of them had ever been taken, and he had sent this particular play to me to read. I didn't know about it, because, of course, I have hundreds of plays sent to me, and I read very few of them myself, only the ones I know something about. Anyway, there it was, and it seems that Mr. Faulkner got a letter from me. And it turned out not to be really from me. You understand?" She paused anxiously, and they assured her they understood. saying that I'd read the play and liked it very much, and would he come down and talk it over with me, and it gave the address, the Bungalow, Riverbury. So Mr. Faulkner was frightfully pleased, and he came down and arrived at this place, the Bungalow. A parlour maid opened the door, and he asked for Miss Hellyer, and she said Miss Hellyer was in and expecting him, and showed him into the drawing-room. And there a woman came to him, and he accepted her as me, as a matter of course. It seems queer, because after all he had seen me act, my photographs are very well known, aren't they? Over the length and breadth of England, said Mrs. Bantry promptly, but there's often a lot of difference between a photograph and its original, my dear Jane, and there's a great deal of difference between behind the footlights and off the stage. It's not every actress who stands the test as well as you do, remember. Well, said Jane, slightly mollified, that may be so. Anyway, he described this woman as tall and fair, with big blue eyes and very good-looking, so I suppose it must have been near enough. He certainly had no suspicions. She sat down and began talking about his play, and said she was anxious to do it. Whilst they were talking, cocktails were brought in, and Mr. Faulkner had one as a matter of course. Well, that's all he remembers, having his cocktail. When he woke up or came to himself, or whatever you call it, he was lying out in the road, by the hedge, of course, so that there would be no danger of his being run over. He felt very queer and shaky. So much so that he just got up and staggered along the road, not quite knowing where he was going. He said if he'd had any senses about him, he'd have gone back to the bungalow and tried to find out what had happened, but he just felt stupid and mazed and walked along without quite knowing what he was doing. He was just more or less coming to himself when the police arrested him. Why did the police arrest him? Asked Dr. Lloyd. Oh, didn't I tell you? Said Jane, opening her eyes very wide. Oh, how very stupid I am. The burglary. You mentioned a burglary, but you didn't say where or what or why, said Mrs. Bantry. Well, this bungalow, the one he went to, of course, it wasn't mine at all. It belonged to a man whose name was... Again Jane furrowed her brows. Do you want me to be godfather again? Asked Sir Henry. Pseudonym supplied free of charge. Describe the tenant and I'll do the naming. It was taken by a rich city man, a knight.
Sir Herman Cohen, suggested Sir Henry.
Oh, that will do beautifully. He took it for a lady. She was the wife of an actor, and she was also an actress herself.
We'll call the actor Claude Leeson, said Sir Henry, and the lady would be known by her stage name, I suppose, so we'll call her Miss Mary Carr.
I think you're awfully clever, said Jane. I don't know how you think of these things so easily. Well, you see, this was sort of a weekend cottage for Sir Herman, did you say Herman, and the lady. And, of course, his wife knew nothing about it.
Which is so often the case, said Sir Henry.
And he'd given this actress woman a good deal of jewellery, including some very fine emeralds.
Ah, said Dr. Lloyd, now we're getting at it.
This jewellery was at the bungalow, just locked up in a jewel case. The police said it was very careless. Anyone might have taken it.
You see, Dolly, said Colonel Bantry, what do I always tell you?
Well, in my experience, said Mrs. Bantry, it's always the people who are so dreadfully careful who lose things. I don't lock mine up in a jewel case. I keep it in a drawer loose under my stockings. I dare say if, what's her name, Mary Carr had done the same thing, it would never have been stolen. It would, said Jane, because all the drawers are burst open and the contents strewn about.
But they weren't really looking for jewels, said Mrs. Bantry. They were looking for secret papers. That's what always happens in books.
I don't know about secret papers, said Jane doubtfully. I never heard of any.
Don't be distracted, Miss Hellyer, said Colonel Bantry. Dolly's wild red herrings are not to be taken seriously. About the burglary, said Sir Henry.
Yes, well, the police were rung up by someone who said that she was Miss Mary Carr. She said the bungalow had been burgled and described a young man with red hair who'd called there that morning. Her maid had thought there was something odd about him and had refused him admittance, but later they'd seen him getting out through a window. She described the man so accurately that the police arrested him only an hour later, and then he told his story and showed them the letter from me. And as I told you, they fetched me, and when he saw me, he said what I told you, that it hadn't been me at all.
A very curious story, said Dr. Lloyd. Did Mr. Faulkner know this, Miss Carr?
No, he didn't.
Or said he didn't.
But I haven't told you the most curious part yet. The police went to the bungalow, of course, and they found everything as described. Drawers pulled out and jewels gone, but the whole place was empty. It wasn't till some hours later that Mary Carr came back, and when she did, she said she'd never rung them up at all, and this was the first she'd heard of it. It seemed that she had had a wire that morning from a manager offering her a most important part and making an appointment, so she'd naturally rushed up to town to keep it. When she got there, she found that the whole thing was a hoax. No telegram had ever been sent. "A common enough ruse to get her out of the way," commented Sir Henry. "What about the servants?" "The same sort of thing happened there. There was only one. She was rung up on the telephone, apparently by Mary Carr, who said she left a most important thing behind. She directed the maid to bring up a certain handbag which was in the drawer of her bedroom. She was to catch the first train. The maid did so, of course, locking up the house. But when she arrived at Miss Carr's club, where she'd been told to meet her mistress, she waited there in vain." Said Sir Henry, "I begin to see. The house was left empty, and to make an entry by one of the windows would present few difficulties, I should imagine. But I don't quite see where this Mr. Faulkner comes in. Who did ring up the police if it wasn't Miss Carr?" "That's what nobody knew or ever found out." "Curious," said Sir Henry. "Did the young man turn out to be genuinely the person he said he was?" "Oh, yes, that part of it was all right. He'd even got the letter, which was supposed to be written by me. It wasn't the least bit like my handwriting. But then, of course, he couldn't be supposed to know that." "Well, let's state the position clearly," said Sir Henry. "Correct me if I go wrong. The lady and the maid are decoyed from the house. The young man is decoyed down there by means of a bogus letter, colour being lent to this last by the fact that you actually are performing at Riverbury that week. The young man is doped, and the police are rung up and have their suspicions directed against him. A burglary actually has taken place. I presume the jewels were taken."
"Oh, yes." "Were they ever recovered?"
"No, never, I think. As a matter of fact, Sir Herman tried to hush things up all he knew how, but he couldn't manage it. And I rather fancy his wife started divorce proceedings in consequence. Still, I don't really know about that."
"What happened to Mr. Leslie Faulkner?"
"He was released in the end. The police said they hadn't really got enough against him. Don't you think the whole thing was rather odd?"
"Distinctly odd.
The first question is whose story to believe?" "In telling it, Miss Hellyer, I notice that you incline towards believing Mr. Faulkner. Have you any reason for doing so, beyond your own instinct in the matter?"
"No," said Jane unwillingly, "I suppose I haven't. But he was so very nice and so apologetic for having mistaken anyone else for me that I feel sure he must mean telling the truth."
"I see," said Sir Henry, smiling, "but you must admit that he could have invented the story quite easily. He could write the letter purporting to be from you himself. He could also dope himself after successfully committing the burglary. But I confess I don't see where the point of all that would be. Easier to enter the house, help himself, and disappear quietly, unless just possibly he was observed by someone in the neighbourhood, and knew himself to have been observed. Then he might hastily concoct this plan for diverting suspicion from himself and accounting for his presence in the neighbourhood."
"Was he well off?"
asked Miss Marple.
"I don't think so," said Jane. "No, I believe he was rather hard up."
"The whole thing seems curious," said Dr. Lloyd. "I must confess that if we accept the young man's story as true, it seems to make the case much more difficult. Why should the unknown woman who pretended to be Miss Hellyer drag this unknown man into the affair? Why should she stage such an elaborate comedy?"
"Tell me, Jane," said Mrs. Bantry, "did young Faulkner ever come face to face with Mary Carr at any stage of the proceedings?"
"I don't quite know," said Jane slowly, as she puzzled her brows in remembrance.
"Because if he didn't, the case is solved," said Mrs. Bantry. "I'm sure I'm right. What is easier than to pretend you're called up to town? You telephone to your maid from Paddington, or whatever station you arrive at, and as she comes up to town, you go down again. The young man calls by appointment. He's doped. You set the stage for the burglary, overdoing it as much as possible. You telephone the police, giving a description of your scapegoat, and off you go to town again. Then you arrive home by a later train and do the surprised innocent."
"But why should she steal her own jewels, Dolly?"
"They always do," said Mrs. Bantry. "Anyway, I can think of hundreds of reasons. She may have wanted money at once.
Old Sir Herman wouldn't give her cash, perhaps, so she pretends the jewels are stolen and then sells them secretly. Or she may have been being blackmailed by someone who threatened to tell her husband or Sir Herman's wife. Or she may have already sold the jewels, and Sir Herman was getting ratty and asking to see them, so she had to do something about it. That's done a good deal in books. Or perhaps she was going to have them reset, and she'd got paste replicas. Or, now here's a very good idea, and not so much done in books. She pretends they're stolen, gets in an awful state, and he gives her a fresh lot, so she gets two lots instead of one. That kind of woman, I'm sure, is most frightfully artful.
You are clever, Dolly, said Jane admiringly. I never thought of that.
You may be clever, but she doesn't say you're right, said Colonel Bantry. I incline to suspicion of the city gentleman. He'd know the sort of telegram to get the lady out of the way, and he could manage the rest easily enough with the help of a new lady friend. Nobody seems to have thought of asking him for an alibi.
What do you think, Miss Marple? Asked Jane, turning towards the old lady who had sat silent, a puzzled frown on her face.
My dear, I really don't know what to say. Sir Henry will laugh, but I recall no village parallel to help me this time. Of course, there are several questions that suggest themselves. For instance, the servant question. In, an irregular menage of the kind you describe, the servant employed would doubtless be perfectly aware of the state of things, and a really nice girl would not take such a place. Her mother wouldn't let her for a minute. So I think we can assume that the maid was not a really trustworthy character. She may have been in league with the thieves. She would leave the house open for them and actually go to London, as though sure of the pretense telephone message, so as to divert suspicion from herself. I must confess that that seems the most probable solution. Only if ordinary thieves were concerned, it seems very odd. It seems to argue more knowledge than the maid-servant was likely to have. Miss Marple paused and then went on dreamily. I can't help feeling that there was some, what I must describe as personal feeling about the whole thing. Supposing somebody had a spite, for instance. Don't you think that that would explain things better and a deliberate attempt to get him into trouble? That's what it looks like. And yet, that's not entirely satisfactory.
"Why, Doctor, you haven't said anything," said Jane. "I'd forgotten you."
"I'm always getting forgotten," said the grizzled doctor sadly. "I must have a very inconspicuous personality."
"Oh, no," said Jane. "Do tell us what you think."
"I'm rather in the position of agreeing with everyone's solutions, and yet with none of them.
I myself have a far-fetched and probably totally erroneous theory that the wife may have had something to do with it. Sir Herman's wife, I mean. I've no grounds for thinking so, only you would be surprised if you knew the extraordinary things that a wronged wife will take it into her head to do."
"Oh, Dr. Lloyd," cried Miss Marple excitedly, "how clever of you! And I never thought of poor Mrs. Pebmarsh." Jane stared at her.
"Mrs. Pebmarsh? Who is Mrs. Pebmarsh?"
"Well," Miss Marple hesitated, "I don't know that she really comes in. She's a laundress, and she stole an opal pin that was pinned into a blouse and put it in another woman's house." Jane looked more fogged than ever.
"And that makes it all perfectly clear to you, Miss Marple," said Sir Henry with a twinkle.
But to his surprise, Miss Marple shook her head. "No, no, I'm afraid it doesn't. I must confess myself completely at a loss. What I do realise is that women must stick together. One should, in an emergency, stand by one's own sex. I think that's the moral of the story Miss Hellyer has told us."
"I must confess that that particular ethical significance of the mystery has escaped me," said Sir Henry gravely. "Perhaps I shall see the significance of your point more clearly when Miss Hellyer has revealed the solution."
"Eh," said Jane, looking rather bewildered.
"I was observing that in childish language we give it up. You and you alone, Miss Hellyer, have had the high honour of presenting such an absolutely baffling mystery that even Miss Marple has to confess herself defeated."
"You all give it up?" asked Jane.
"Yes."
After a minute's silence, during which he waited for the others to speak, Sir Henry constituted himself spokesman once more.
"That is to say, we stand or fall by the sketchy solutions we have tentatively advanced. One each for the mere men, two for Miss Marple, and a round dozen for Mrs. B. It was not a dozen, said Mrs. Bantry. They were variations on a main theme. And how often am I to tell you that I will not be called Mrs. B? So you all give up, said Jane thoughtfully. That's very interesting. She leant back in her chair and began to polish her nails rather absent-mindedly. Well, said Mrs. Bantry, come on, Jane, what's the solution? The solution? Yes, what really happened? Jane stared at her. I haven't the least idea.
What?
I've always wondered. I thought you were all so clever, one of you would be able to tell me. Everybody harbored feelings of annoyance. It was all very well for Jane to be so beautiful, but at the moment everyone felt that stupidity could be carried too far. Even the most transcendent loveliness could not excuse it. You mean the truth was never discovered, said Sir Henry. No, that's why, as I say, I did think that you would be able to tell me.
Jane sounded injured. It was plain that she felt she'd had a grievance.
Well, I'm, said Colonel Bantry, words failing him. You are the most aggravating girl, Jane, said his wife. Anyway, I'm sure on all Shelby that I was right. If you just tell us the proper names of all the people, I shall be quite sure.
I don't think I could do that, said Jane slowly.
No, dear, said Miss Marple. Miss Hellier couldn't do that.
Of course she could, said Mrs. Bantry. Don't be so high-minded, Jane. We older folks must have a bit of scandal. At any rate, tell us who the city magnate was.
But Jane shook her head, and Miss Marple, in her old-fashioned way, continued to support the girl. It must have been a very distressing business, she said.
No, said Jane truthfully, I think I rather enjoyed it.
Well, perhaps you did, said Miss Marple. I suppose it was a break in the monotony. What play were you acting in?
Smith!
Oh, yes, that's one of Mr. Somerset Maugham's, isn't it? All his are very clever, I think. I've seen them nearly all.
You're reviving it to go on tour next autumn, aren't you? Asked Mrs. Bantry.
Jane nodded. Well, said Miss Marple, rising, I must go home. Such late hours. But we've had a very entertaining evening. Most unusually so. I think Miss Hellier's story wins the prize, don't you agree?
I'm sorry you're angry with me, said Jane, about not knowing the end, I mean. I suppose I should have said so sooner.
Her tone sounded wistful. Dr. Lloyd rose gallantly to the occasion.
My dear young lady, why should you? You gave us a very pretty problem to sharpen our wits upon. I'm only sorry we none of us could solve it convincingly.
Speak for yourself, said Mrs. Bantry. I did solve it. I'm convinced I'm right.
Do you know, I really believe you are, said Jane. What you said sounded so probable.
Which of her seven solutions do you refer to? Asked Sir Henry teasingly.
Dr. Lloyd gallantly assisted Miss Marple to put on her galoshes. Just in case, as the old lady explained. The doctor was to be her escort to her old world cottage. Wrapped in several woolen shawls, Miss Marple wished everyone good night once more. She came to Jane Hellier last, and leaning forward, she murmured something in the actress's ear. A startled, "Oh!" burst from Jane, so loud as to cause the others to turn their heads. Smiling and nodding, Miss Marple made her exit. Jane Hellier stared after her.
"Are you coming to bed, Jane?" asked Mrs. Bantry. "What's the matter with you? You're staring as though you'd seen a ghost."
With a deep sigh, Jane came to herself. She had a beautiful and bewildering smile on the two men and followed her hostess up the staircase.
Mrs. Bantry came into the girl's room with her. "Your fire's nearly out," said Mrs. Bantry, giving it a vicious and ineffectual poke. "They can't have made it up properly. How stupid housemaids are still. I suppose we are rather late tonight." Why, it's actually past 1 o'clock.
Do you think there are many people like her? Asked Jane Hellier. She was sitting on the side of the bed, apparently wrapped in thought.
Like the housemaid?
No. Like that funny old woman. What's her name? Marple.
Oh, I don't know. I suppose she's a fairly common type in a small village.
Oh, dear, said Jane. I don't know what to do. She sighed deeply.
What's the matter?
I'm worried. What about?
Dolly, Jane Hillier was portentously solemn, do you know what that queer old lady whispered to me before she went out of the door tonight?
No, what? She said, I shouldn't do it if I were you, my dear. Never put yourself too much in another woman's power, even if you think she's your friend at the moment.
You know, Dolly, that's awfully true.
The maxim, yes, perhaps it is, but I don't see the application.
I suppose you can't ever really trust a woman, and I should be in her power. I never thought of that.
What woman are you talking about?
Netta Green, my understudy.
What on earth does Miss Marple know about your understudy?
I suppose she guessed, but I can't see how.
Jane, will you kindly tell me at once what you're talking about?
The story.
The one I told you.
Oh, Dolly, that woman, you know, the one that took Claude from me.
Mrs. Bantry nodded, casting her mind back rapidly to the first of Jane's unfortunate marriages, to Claude Averbury, the actor.
He married her. I could have told him how it would be.
Claude doesn't know, but she's carrying on with Sir Joseph Salmon. Weekends with him at the bungalow I told you about. I wanted her shown up. I'd like everyone to know the sort of woman she was, and you see, with a burglary, everything would be bound to come out.
Jane, gasped Mrs. Bantry, did you engineer this story you've been telling us?
Jane nodded.
That's why I chose Smith. I wear parlourmaid's kit in it, you know, so I should have it handy. And when they sent for me to the police station, it's the easiest thing in the world, say I was rehearsing my part of my understudy at the hotel. Really, of course, we would be at the bungalow. I just have to open the door and bring in the cocktails, and Netta to pretend to be me. He'd never see her again, of course, so there would be no fear of his recognising her. And I can make myself look quite different as a parlourmaid, and besides, one doesn't look at parlourmaids as though they were people. We plan to drag him out into the road afterwards, bag the jewel case, telephone the police, and get back to the hotel. I shouldn't like the poor young man to suffer, but Sir Henry didn't seem to think he would, did he? And she'd be in the papers and everything, and Claude would see what she was really like. Mrs. Bantry sat down and groaned. Oh, my poor head, and all the time. Jane Hillier, you deceitful girl, telling us that story the way you did. I am a good actress, said Jane complacently. I always have been, whatever people choose to say. I didn't give myself away once, did I?
Miss Marple was right, murmured Mrs. Bantry, the personal element. Oh, yes, the personal element. Jane, my good child, you realise that theft is theft, and you might have been sent to prison.
Well, none of you guessed, said Jane,
except Miss Marple.
The worried expression returned to her face.
Dolly, do you really think there are many like her?
Frankly, I don't, said Mrs. Bantry. Jane sighed again.
Oh, well, still one had better not risk it, and of course I should be in Netta's power, that's true enough. She might turn against me or blackmail me or anything. She helped me think out the details, and she professed to be devoted to me, but one never does know with women. No, I think Miss Marple's right, I'd better not risk it.
But, my dear, you have risked it.
Oh, no, Jane opened her blue eyes very wide. Don't you understand? None of this has happened yet. I was, well, trying it on the dog, so to speak.
I don't profess to understand your theatrical slang, said Mrs. Bantry with dignity.
Do you mean this is a future project, not a past deed?
I was going to do it this autumn, in September.
I don't know what to do now.
And Jane Marple guessed, actually guessed the truth and never told us, said Mrs. Bantry wrathfully.
I think that was why she said about women sticking together. She wouldn't give me away before the men. That was nice of her. I don't mind your knowing, Dolly.
Well, give the idea up, Jane, I beg of you.
I think I shall, murmured Miss Hillier. There might be other Miss Marples.
The Thumb Mark of St. Peter. "And now, Aunt Jane, it's up to you," said Raymond West, who was host that evening to a group of friends. There was Joyce Lompierre, the artist, with her close-cropped black hair and queer hazel-green eyes, and Sir Henry Clithering, ex-commissioner of Scotland Yard. There was Dr. Pender, the elderly clergyman of the parish, and Mr. Petherick, the solicitor, a dried-up little man with eyeglasses which he looked over and not through. And, of course, there was his Aunt Jane. Raymond looked across the hearth to where she sat erect in the big grandfather chair. Miss Marple wore a black brocade dress, very much pinched in round the waist. Her faded blue eyes, benignant and kindly, looked up at the mention of her name. "Yes, Aunt Jane, we're expecting something really spicy," chimed in Joyce Lompierre. "Now you're laughing at me, my dear," said Miss Marple placidly. "You think that because I've lived in this out-of-the-way spot all my life, I am not likely to have had any very interesting experiences." "God forbid that I should ever regard village life as peaceful and uneventful," said Raymond with fervour. "Not after the horrible revelations we've heard from you. The cosmopolitan world seems a mild and peaceful place compared with St. Mary Mead." "Well, my dear," said Miss Marple, "human nature is much the same everywhere, and of course one has opportunities of observing it at closer quarters in a village." "You really are unique, Aunt Jane," cried Joyce. "I hope you don't mind me calling you Aunt Jane," she added. "I don't know why I do it." "Don't you, my dear?" said Miss Marple. She looked up for a moment or two with something quizzical in her glance, which made the blood flame to the girl's cheeks. Raymond West fidgeted and cleared his throat in a somewhat embarrassed manner. Miss Marple looked at them both and smiled again, and bent her attention once more to her knitting. "It is true, of course, that I've lived what is called a very uneventful life, but I've had a lot of experiences in solving different little problems that have arisen. Some of them have been really quite ingenious, but it would be no good telling them to you because they are about such unimportant things that you would not be interested. Just things like who cut the meshes of Mrs. Jones' string bag and why Mrs. Sims only wore her new fur coat once. Very interesting things, really, to any student of human nature. No, the only experience that I can remember that would be of interest to you is the one about my poor niece Mabel's husband. It's about 10 or 15 years ago now, and happily it's all over and done with, and everyone has forgotten about it. People's memories are very short. A lucky thing, I will think." Miss Marple paused and murmured to herself, "I must just count this row. The decreasing is a little awkward. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 3 pearl. Yes, that's right. Now, what was I saying? Oh, yes, about poor Mabel. Mabel was my niece, a nice girl, really, a very nice girl, but just a trifle what one might call silly. Rather fond of being melodramatic and of saying a great deal more than she meant whenever she was upset. She married a Mr. Denman when she was 22, and I'm afraid it was not a very happy marriage. I'd hoped very much that the attachment would not come to anything, for Mr. Denman was a man of very violent temper, not the kind of man who would be patient with Mabel's foibles. I also learnt that there was insanity in his family. However, girls were just as obstinate then as they are now, and as they always will be, and Mabel married him. I didn't see very much of her after her marriage. She came to stay with me once or twice, and they asked me there several times, but as a matter of fact I'm not very fond of staying in other people's houses, and I always manage to make some excuse. They'd been married 10 years when Mr. Denman died suddenly. There were no children, and he left all his money to Mabel. I wrote, of course, and offered to come to Mabel if she wanted me, but she wrote back a very sensible letter, and I gathered that she was not altogether overwhelmed by grief. I thought that was only natural, because I knew they'd not be getting on well together for some time. It was not until about 3 months afterwards that I got a most hysterical letter from Mabel, begging me to come to her, and saying that things were going from bad to worse, and she couldn't stand it much longer. So, of course, continued Miss Marple, I put Clara on board wages, and sent the plate and the King Charles tankard to the bank, and I went off at once.
I found Mabel in a very nervous state. The house, Myrtle Dean, was a fairly large one, very comfortably furnished. There was a cook and a house parlour maid, as well as a nurse attendant to look after old Mr. Denman, Mabel's husband's father, who was what is called not quite right in the head. Quite peaceful and well-behaved, but distinctly odd at times. As I say, there was insanity in the family. I was really shocked to see the change in Mabel. She was a mass of nerves, twitching all over, and yet I had the greatest difficulty in making her tell me what the trouble was. I got at it, as one always does get at these things, indirectly. I asked her about some friends of hers she was always mentioning in her letters, the Gallaghers. She said, to my surprise, that she hardly ever saw them nowadays. Other friends whom I mentioned elicited the same remark. I spoke to her then of the folly of shutting herself up and brooding, and especially of the silliness of cutting herself adrift from her friends. Then she came bursting out with the truth. "It's not my doing, it's theirs. There's not a soul in the place who'll speak to me now. When I go down the high street, they all get out of the way, so that they shan't have to meet me or speak to me. I'm a kind of leper. It's awful. I can't bear it any longer. I shall have to sell the house and go abroad. Yet why should I be driven away from home like this? I've done nothing." I was more disturbed than I can tell you. I was knitting a comforter for old Mrs. Hay at the time, and in my perturbation I dropped 2 stitches and never discovered it until long after. "My dear Mabel," I said, "you amaze me. But what is the cause of all this?" Even as a child, Mabel was always difficult. I had the greatest difficulty in getting her to give me a straightforward answer to my question. She would only say vague things about wicked talk and idle people who had nothing better to do than gossip, and people who put ideas into other people's heads. "That is all quite clear to me," I said. "There is evidently some story being circulated about you. But what that story is, you must know as well as anyone. And you are going to tell me." "It's so wicked," moaned Mabel. "Of course it's wicked," I said briskly. "There's nothing that you can tell me about people's minds that would astonish or surprise me. Now, Mabel, will you tell me in plain English what people are saying about you?" Then it all came out. It seemed that Geoffrey Denman's death, being quite sudden and unexpected, gave rise to various rumours. In fact, and in plain English, as I had put it to her, people were saying that she had poisoned her husband. Now, as I expect you know, there is nothing more cruel than talk, and there is nothing more difficult to combat. When people say things behind your back, there is nothing you can refute or deny. And the rumours go on growing and growing, and no one can stop them. I was quite certain of one thing. Mabel was quite incapable of poisoning anyone, and I didn't see why life should be ruined for her and her home made unbearable just because, in all probability, she had been doing something silly and foolish. "There is no smoke without fire," I said. "Now, Mabel, you've got to tell me what started people off on this tack. There must have been something." Mabel was very incoherent, and declared there was nothing, nothing at all, except, of course, that Geoffrey's death had been very sudden. He had seemed quite well at supper that evening and had taken violently ill in the night. The doctor had been sent for, but the poor man had died a few minutes after the doctor's arrival. Death had been thought to be the result of eating poisoned mushrooms. "Well," I said, "I suppose a sudden death of that kind might start tongues wagging, but surely not without some additional facts. Did you have a quarrel with Geoffrey or anything of that kind?" She admitted that she had had a quarrel with him on the preceding morning at breakfast time. "And the servants heard it, I suppose," I asked. "They weren't in the room." "No, my dear," I said, "but they probably were fairly near the door outside." I knew the carrying power of Mabel's high-pitched hysterical voice only too well. Geoffrey Denman, too, was a man given to raising his voice loudly when angry. "What did you quarrel about?" I asked. "Oh, the usual things. It was always the same things over and over again. Some little thing would start us off, and then Geoffrey became impossible and said abominable things, and I told him what I thought of him." "There had been a lot of quarrelling then," I asked. "It wasn't my fault." "My dear child," I said, "it doesn't matter whose fault it was. That is not what we are discussing. In a place like this, everybody's private affairs are more or less public property. You and your husband were always quarrelling. You had a particularly bad quarrel one morning, and that night your husband died suddenly and mysteriously. Is that all? Or is there anything else?
I don't know what you mean by anything else, said Mabel sullenly.
Just what I say, my dear. If you've done anything silly, don't, for heaven's sake, keep it back now. I only want to do what I can to help you.
Nothing and nobody can help, said Mabel wildly, except death.
Have a little more faith in Providence, dear, I said. Now then, Mabel, I know perfectly well there is something else you are keeping back. I always did know, even when she was a child, when she was not telling me the whole truth. It took a long time, but I got it out at last. She had gone down to the chemist's that morning and had bought some arsenic. She had had, of course, to sign the book for it. Naturally, the chemist had talked. "Who is your doctor?" I asked. "Dr. Rawlinson." I knew him by sight. Mabel had pointed him out to me the other day. To put it in perfectly plain language, he was what I would describe as an old dodderer. I've had too much experience of life to believe in the infallibility of doctors. Some of them are clever men and some of them are not, and half the time the best of them don't know what is the matter with you. I have no truck with doctors and their medicines myself. I thought things over, and then I put my bonnet on and went to call on Dr. Rawlinson. He was just what I had thought him, a nice old man, kindly, vague, and so short-sighted as to be pitiful, slightly deaf, and withal touchy and sensitive to the last degree. He was on his high horse at once when I mentioned Geoffrey Denman's death, talked for a long time about various kinds of fungi, edible and otherwise. He had questioned the cook, and she had admitted that one or two of the mushrooms cooked had been a little queer. But as the shop had sent them, she thought they must be all right. The more she thought about them since, the more she was convinced that their appearance was unusual. She would be, I said. They would start by being quite like mushrooms in appearance, and they would end by being orange with purple spots. There is nothing that class cannot remember if it tries. I gathered that Denman had been past speech when the doctor got to him. He was incapable of swallowing and had died within a few minutes. The doctor seemed perfectly satisfied with the certificate he had given. But how much of that was obstinacy, and how much of it was genuine belief, I could not be sure. I went straight home, and I asked Mabel quite frankly why she had bought arsenic. "You must have had some idea in your mind," I pointed out. Mabel burst into tears. "I wanted to make away with myself," she moaned. "I was too unhappy. I thought I would end it all." "Have you the arsenic still?" I asked. "No, I threw it away." I sat there turning things over and over in my mind. "What happened when he was taken ill? Did he call you?" "No," she shook her head. "He rang the bell violently, and he must have rung several times. At last Dorothy, the house parlourmaid, heard it, and she waked the cook up, and they came down. When Dorothy saw him, she was frightened. He was rambling and delirious. She left the cook with him and came rushing to me. I got up and went to him. Of course, I saw at once he was dreadfully ill. Unfortunately, Brewster, who looked after old Mr. Denman, was away for the night, so there was no one who knew what to do. I sent Dorothy off for the doctor, and Cook and I stayed with him, but after a few minutes I couldn't bear it any longer. It was too dreadful. I ran away to my room and locked the door.
Very selfish and unkind of you, I said. No doubt that conduct of yours has done nothing to help you since. You may be sure of that. Cook will have repeated it everywhere. Well, well, this is a bad business. Next I spoke to the servants. The cook wanted to tell me about the mushrooms, but I stopped her. I was tired of these mushrooms. Instead, I questioned both of them very closely about their master's condition on that night. They both agreed that he seemed to be in great agony, that he was unable to swallow, and he could only speak in a strangled voice, and when he did speak, it was only rambling, nothing sensible.
What did he say when he was rambling? I asked curiously. Something about fish, wasn't it? Turning to the other. Dorothy agreed. "A heap of fish," she said. "Some nonsense like that. I could see at once he wasn't in his right mind, poor gentleman."
There didn't seem to be any sense to be made out of that. As a last resource, I went up to see Brewster, who was a gaunt, middle-aged woman of about 50. "It's a pity that I wasn't here that night," she said. "Nobody seems to have tried to do anything for him until the doctor came." "I suppose he was delirious," I said doubtfully, "but that is not a symptom of ptomaine poisoning, is it?" "Depends," said Brewster. I asked her how her patient was getting on. She shook her head. "It's pretty bad," she said. "Weak?" "Oh, no, no, he's strong enough physically. All but his eyesight, that's failing badly. May outlive all of us, but his mind's failing very fast now. I told both Mr. and Mrs. Denman that he ought to be in an institution, but Mrs. Denman wouldn't hear of it at any price." I will say for Mabel that she always had a kindly heart. Well, there the thing was. I thought it over in every aspect, and at last I decided there was only one thing to be done. In view of the rumours that were going about, permission must be sought to exhume the body, and a proper post-mortem must be made, and lying tongues quietened once and for all. Mabel, of course, made a fuss mostly on sentimental grounds, disturbing the dead man in his peaceful grave, etc., etc., but I was firm. I won't make a long story of this part of it. We got the lauder, and they did the autopsy, or whatever they call it, but the result was not so satisfactory as it might have been. There was no trace of arsenic. That was all to the good. But the actual words of the report were that there was nothing to show by what means deceased had come to his death. So you see, that didn't lead us out of trouble altogether. People went on talking about rare poisons impossible to detect and rubbish of that sort. I'd seen the pathologist who had done the post-mortem, and I'd asked him several questions, though he tried his best to get out of answering most of them. But I got out of him that he considered it highly unlikely that the poisoned mushrooms were the cause of death. An idea was simmering in my mind, and I asked him what poison, if any, could have been employed to obtain that result. He made a long explanation to me, most of which I must admit I did not follow, but it amounted to this. The death might have been due to some strong vegetable alkaloid. The idea I had was this. Supposing the taint of insanity was in Geoffrey Denman's blood also, might he not have made away with himself? He had at one period of his life studied medicine, and he would have a good knowledge of poisons and their effects. I didn't think it sounded very likely, but it was the only thing I could think of, and I was nearly at my wit's end, I can tell you. Now, I dare say you modern young people will laugh, but when I am in really bad trouble, I always say a little prayer to myself. Anywhere, when I'm walking, along the street, or at a bazaar, and I always get an answer. It may be some trifling thing, apparently quite unconnected with the subject, but there it is. I had that text pinned over my bed when I was a little girl. Ask, and you shall receive. On the morning that I'm telling you about, I was walking along the high street, and I was praying hard. I shut my eyes, and when I opened them, do you think was the first thing that I saw? 5 faces with various degrees of interest were turned to Miss Marple. It may be safely assumed, however, that no one would have guessed the answer to the question right. I saw, said Miss Marple impressively, the window of the fishmonger's shop. There was only one thing in it, a fresh haddock. She looked round triumphantly. Oh, my God, said Raymond West, an answer to a prayer, a fresh haddock. Yes, Raymond, said Miss Marple severely, and there's no need to be so profane about it. The hand of God is everywhere. The first thing I saw were the black spots, the marks of St. Peter's thumb, that is the legend, you know, St. Peter's thumb. And that brought things home to me. I needed faith, the ever-true faith of St. Peter. I connected the two things together, faith and fish. Sir Henry blew his nose rather hurriedly. Joyce bit her lip. Now, what did that bring to my mind? Of course, both the cook and the house parlourmaid mentioned fish as being one of the things spoken of by the dying man. I was convinced, absolutely convinced, that there was some solution of the mystery to be found in these words. I went home determined to get to the bottom of the matter. She paused.
Has it ever occurred to you, the old lady went on, how much we go by what is called, I believe, the context? There's a place on Dartmoor called Grey Weathers. If you were talking to a farmer there and mentioned Grey Weathers, he would probably conclude that you were speaking of these stone circles. Yet it's possible that you might be speaking of the atmosphere. And in the same way, if you were meaning the stone circles, an outsider hearing a fragment of the conversation might think you meant the weather. So when we repeat a conversation, we don't, as a rule, repeat the actual words. We put in some other words that seem to us to mean exactly the same thing. I saw both the cook and Dorothy separately. I asked the cook if she was quite sure that her master had really mentioned a heap of fish. She said she was quite sure. Were these his exact words, I asked, or did he mention some particular kind of fish? That's it, said the cook. It was some particular kind of fish, but I can't remember what now. A heap of... Now, what was it? Not any of the fish you sent to table. Would it be a perch now, or pike? No, it didn't begin with a P. Dorothy also recalled that her master had mentioned some special kind of fish. Some outlandish kind of fish it was, she said. A pile of... Oh, now what was it? Did he say heap or pile, I asked. I think he said pile, but there, I really can't be sure. It's so hard to remember the actual words, isn't it, miss, especially when they don't seem to make sense. Now I come to think of it, I'm pretty sure it was a pile, and the fish began with C. But it wasn't a cod or a crayfish. The next part is where I really am proud of myself, said Miss Marple, because, of course, I don't know anything about drugs. Nasty, dangerous things, I call them. I've got an old recipe of my grandmother's for tansy tea that is worth any amount of your drugs. But I knew that there were several medical volumes in the house, and in one of them there was an index of drugs. You see, my idea was that Geoffrey had taken some particular poison and was trying to say the name of it. Well, I looked down the list of H's, beginning H-E. Nothing there that sounded likely. Then I began on the P's, and almost at once I came to, what do you think? She looked round, postponing her moment of triumph. Pilocarpine. Can't you understand a man who could hardly speak, trying to drag that word out? What would that sound like to a cook who had never heard the word? Wouldn't it convey the impression, pile of carp?
By Jove, said Sir Henry. I should never have hit upon that, said Dr. Pender.
Most interesting, said Mr. Petherick, really most interesting. I turned quickly to the page indicated in the index. I read about pilocarpine and its effect on the eyes and other things that didn't seem to have any bearing on the case, but at last I came to a most significant phrase. Has been tried with success as an antidote for atropine poisoning. I can't tell you the light that dawned upon me then. I never had thought it likely that Geoffrey Denman would commit suicide. No, this new solution was not only possible, but I was absolutely sure it was the correct one, because all the pieces fitted in logically.
I'm not going to try to guess, said Raymond. Go on, Aunt Jane, and tell us what was so startlingly clear to you.
I don't know anything about medicine, of course, said Miss Marple, but I did happen to know this, that when my eyesight was failing, the doctor ordered me drops with atropine sulphate in them. I went straight upstairs to old Mr. Denman's room. I didn't beat about the bush. Mr. Denman, I said, I know everything. Why did you poison your son? He looked at me for a minute or two. Rather a handsome old man he was in his way. And then he burst out laughing. It was one of the most vicious laughs I've ever heard. I can assure you it made my flesh creep. I had only heard anything like it once before, when poor Mrs. Jones went off her head.
Yes, he said, I got even with Geoffrey. I was too clever for Geoffrey. Going to put me away, was he? Have me shut up in an asylum. I heard them talking about it. Mabel's a good girl. Mabel stuck up for me, but I knew she wouldn't be able to stand up against Geoffrey. In the end, he would have had his own way, always did, but I settled him. I settled my kind, loving son. Ha ha! I crept down in the night. It was quite easy. Brewster was away. My dear son was asleep. He had a glass of water by the side of his bed. He always woke up in the middle of the night and drank it off. I poured it away. Ha ha! And I emptied the bottle of eye drops into the glass. He would wake up and swill it down before he knew what it was. There was only a tablespoonful of it. Quite enough, quite enough. And so he did. They came to me in the morning and broke it to me very gently. They were afraid it would upset me. Ha 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 ha! Well, said Miss Marple, that's the end of the story. Of course, the poor old man was put in an asylum. He wasn't really responsible for what he'd done, and the truth was known, and everyone was sorry for Mabel and could not do enough to make up to her for the unjust suspicions that Ed had. But if it hadn't been for Geoffrey realizing what the stuff was he had swallowed, and trying to get everybody to get hold of the antidote without delay, it might never have been found out. I believe there are very definite symptoms with atropine, dilated pupils of the eyes and all that, but of course, as I've said, Dr. Rawlinson was very short-sighted, poor old man. And in the same medical book which I went on reading, and some of it was most interesting, it gave the symptoms of ptomaine poisoning and atropine, and they are not unlike. But I can assure you, I've never seen a pile of fresh haddock without thinking of the thumb mark of St. Peter. There was a very long pause. My dear friend, said Mr. Petherick, my very dear friend, you really are amazing.
I shall recommend Scotland Yard to come to you for advice, said Sir Henry.
Well, at all events, Aunt Jane, said Raymond, there's one thing that you don't know.
Oh, yes, I do, dear, said Miss Marple. It happened just before dinner, didn't it? When you took Joyce out to admire the sunset. It's a very favourite place, that. There by the jasmine hedge. That is where the milkman asked Annie if he could put up the bands.
Dash it all, Aunt Jane, said Raymond. Don't spoil all the romance. Joyce and I aren't like the milkman and Annie.
That is where you make a mistake, dear, said Miss Marple. Everybody is very much alike, really. But fortunately, perhaps, they don't realize it.
Death by Drowning. Sir Henry Clithering, ex-commissioner of Scotland Yard, was staying with his friend the Bantrys at their place near the little village of St. Mary Mead. On Saturday morning, coming down to breakfast at the pleasant, guestly hour of 10:15, he almost collided with his hostess, Mrs. Bantry, in the doorway of the breakfast room. She was rushing from the room, evidently in a condition of some excitement and distress. Colonel Bantry was sitting at the table, his face rather redder than usual. "Morning, Clithering," he said. "Nice day. Help yourself." Sir Henry obeyed. As he took his seat, a plate of kidneys and bacon in front of him, his host went on. "Dolly's a bit upset this morning."
"Yes, I rather thought so," said Sir Henry mildly.
He wondered a little. His hostess was of a placid disposition, little given to moods or excitements. As far as Sir Henry knew, she felt keenly on one subject only, gardening.
"Yes," said Colonel Bantry, "a bit of news we got this morning upset her. Girl in the village. Emmett's daughter. Emmett, who keeps the Blue Boar."
"Oh, yes, of course."
"Yes," said Colonel Bantry thoughtfully. "Pretty girl. Got herself into trouble. Usual story. I've been arguing with Dolly about that. Foolish of me. Women never see sense. Dolly was all up in arms for the girl. You know what women are. Men are brutes, all the rest of it, etc. But it's not so simple as all that. Not in these days. Girls know what they're about. Fellow who seduces a girl is not necessarily a villain. 50-50 as often as not. I rather liked young Sanford myself, a young ass, rather than a Don Juan, I should have said. Is it this man Sanford who has got the girl into trouble?" "So it seems, of course. I don't know anything personally," said the Colonel cautiously. "It's all gossip and chat. You know what this place is. As I say, I know nothing, and I'm not like Dolly, leaping to conclusions, flinging accusations all over the place. Damn it all, one ought to be careful in what one says. You know, inquest and all that."
"Inquest?"
Colonel Bantry stared. Yes, didn't I tell you? Girl drowned herself. That's what all the pother's about. That's a nasty business, said Sir Henry. Of course it is. Don't like to think of it myself. Poor pretty little devil. Her father's a hard man by all accounts. I suppose she just felt she couldn't face the music. He paused. That's what upset Dolly so. Where did she drown herself? In the river, just below the mill. It runs pretty fast. There's a footpath and a bridge across. They think she threw herself off that. Oh, well, well. Doesn't bear thinking about. And with a portentous rustle, Colonel Bantry opened his newspaper and proceeded to distract his mind from painful matters by an absorption in the newest iniquities of the government. Sir Henry was only mildly interested by the village tragedy. After breakfast, he established himself on a comfortable chair on the lawn, tilted his hat over his eyes, and contemplated life from a peaceful angle. It was about 11:30 when a neat parlourmaid tripped across the lawn. "If you please, sir, Miss Marple has called and would like to see you." "Miss Marple?" Sir Henry sat up and straightened his hat. The name surprised him. He remembered Miss Marple very well, her gentle, quiet, old maidish ways, her amazing penetration. He remembered a dozen unsolved and hypothetical cases, and how in each case this typical old maid of the village had leapt unerringly to the right solution of the mystery. Sir Henry had a very deep respect for Miss Marple. He wondered what had brought her to see him. Miss Marple was sitting in the drawing-room, very upright as always, a gaily coloured marketing basket of foreign extraction beside her. Her cheeks were rather pink, and she seemed flustered. "Oh, Sir Henry, I'm so glad, so fortunate to find you. I just happened to hear that you were staying down here. I do hope that you'll forgive me." "This is a great pleasure," said Sir Henry, taking her hand. "I'm afraid Mrs. Bantry's out." "Yes," said Miss Marple. "I saw her talking to Footit, the butcher, as I passed. Henry Footit was run over yesterday. That was his dog, one of those smooth-haired fox terriers, rather stout and quarrelsome, that butchers always seem to have." "Yes," said Sir Henry helpfully. "I was glad to get her when she wasn't at home," continued Miss Marple, "because it was you I wanted to see about this sad affair." "Henry Footit?" asked Sir Henry, slightly bewildered. Miss Marple threw him a reproachful glance. "No, no. Rose Emmett, of course. You've heard?" Sir Henry nodded. "Bantry was telling me. Very sad." He was a little puzzled. He couldn't conceive why Miss Marple should want to see him about Rose Emmett. Miss Marple sat down again. Sir Henry also sat. When the old lady spoke, her manner had changed. It was grave and had a certain dignity. "You may remember, Sir Henry, that on one or two occasions we played what was really a pleasant kind of game, propounding the mysteries and giving solutions. You were kind enough to say that I didn't do too badly." "You beat us all," said Sir Henry warmly. "You displayed an absolute genius for getting to the truth. And you always instant, I remember, some village parallel which had supplied you with the clue." He smiled as he spoke, but Miss Marple did not smile. She remained very grave. "What you have said has emboldened me to come to you now. I feel that if I say something to you, at least you will not laugh at me." He realized suddenly that she was in deadly earnest. "Certainly. I won't laugh," he said gently. "Sir Henry, this girl, Rose Emmett, she did not drown herself. She was murdered, and I know who murdered her." Sir Henry was silent with sheer astonishment for quite 3 seconds. Miss Marple's voice had been perfectly quiet and unexcited. She might have been making the most ordinary statement in the world for all the emotion she showed. "That is a very serious statement to make, Miss Marple," said Sir Henry when he had recovered his breath. She nodded her head gently several times. "I know, I know. That is why I've come to you." "But, my dear lady, I'm not the person to come to. I'm merely a private individual nowadays. If you have knowledge of the kind you claim, you must go to the police." "I don't think I can do that," said Miss Marple.
"Why not?"
"Because, you see, I haven't got any, what you call, knowledge. You mean it's only a guess on your part?
You can call it that if you like, but it's not really that at all.
I know. I'm in a position to know, but if I gave my reasons for knowing to Inspector Druitt, well, he'd simply laugh, and really, I don't know that I'd blame him. It's very difficult to understand what you might call specialized knowledge.
Such as, suggested Sir Henry. Miss Marple smiled a little.
If I were to tell you that I know because of a man called Peasgood leaving turnips instead of carrots when he came round with a cart and sold vegetables to my niece several years ago.
She stopped eloquently.
A very appropriate name for the trade, murmured Sir Henry. You mean that you are simply judging from the facts in a parallel case?
I know human nature, said Miss Marple. It's impossible not to know human nature living in a village all these years. The question is, do you believe me, or don't you? She looked at him very straight. The pink flush had heightened on her cheeks. Her eyes met his steadily without wavering.
Sir Henry was a man with a very vast experience of life. He made his decisions quickly without beating about the bush. Unlikely and fantastic as Miss Marple's statement might seem, he was instantly aware that he accepted it.
I do believe you, Miss Marple, but I do not see what you want me to do in the matter, or why you've come to me.
I have thought and thought about it, said Miss Marple. As I said, it would be useless going to the police without any facts. I have no facts. What I would ask you to do is to interest yourself in the matter. Inspector Druitt would be most flattered, I'm sure. And, of course, if the matter went farther, Colonel Melchett, the chief constable, I'm sure, would be wax in your hands.
She looked at him appealingly.
And what data are you going to give me to work upon?
I thought, said Miss Marple, of writing a name, the name, on a piece of paper and giving it to you. Then, if on investigation you decide that the person is not involved in any way, well, I shall have been quite wrong. She paused and then added with a slight shiver, oh, it would be so dreadful, so very dreadful, if an innocent person were to be hanged.
What on earth? Cried Sir Henry, startled.
She turned a distressed face upon him. I may be wrong about that, though I don't think so. Inspector Druitt, you see, is really an intelligent man, but a mediocre amount of intelligence is sometimes most dangerous. It doesn't take one far enough.
Sir Henry looked at her curiously.
Fumbling a little, Miss Marple opened a small reticule. She took out a little notebook, tore out a leaf, carefully wrote a name on it, and folding it in two, handed it to Sir Henry. He opened it and read the name. It conveyed nothing to him, but his eyebrows lifted a little. He looked across at Miss Marple and tucked the piece of paper in his pocket.
Well, well, he said, rather an extraordinary business, this. I've never done anything like it before. But I'm going to back my judgment of you, Miss Marple.
Sir Henry was sitting in a room with Colonel Melchett, the chief constable of the county, and Inspector Druitt. The chief constable was a little man of aggressively military demeanour. The inspector was big and broad and eminently sensible.
I really do feel I'm butting in, said Sir Henry with a pleasant smile. I can't really tell you why I'm doing it.
Strict truth, this.
My dear fellow, we're charmed. It's a great compliment.
Honoured, Sir Henry, said the inspector. The chief constable was thinking, bored to death, poor old fellow at the Bantries. The old man abusing the government and the old woman babbling on about bulbs.
The inspector was thinking, pity we're not up against a real teaser. One of the best brains in England, I've heard it said. Pity it's all such plain sailing.
Aloud, the chief constable said,
I'm afraid it's all very sordid and straightforward. First idea was that the girl had pitched herself in. She was in the family way, you understand. However, our doctor, Haydock, is a careful fellow. He noticed the bruises on each arm, upper arm, caused before death, just where a fellow would have taken her by the arms and flung her in.
Would that require much strength?
I think not. There'd be no struggle. The girl would be taken unawares. It's a footbridge of slippery wood, easiest thing in the world to pitch her over. There's no handrail on that side.
You know for a fact that the tragedy occurred there?
Yes, we've got a boy, Jimmy Brown, aged 12. He was in the woods on the other side. He heard a kind of scream from the bridge and a splash. It was dusk, you know, difficult to see anything. Presently he saw something white floating down in the water, and he ran and got help. They got her out, but it was too late to revive her. Sir Henry nodded. The boy saw no one on the bridge? No, but as I tell you, it was dusk, and there's a mist always hanging about there. I'm going to question him as to whether he saw anyone about just afterwards or just before. You see, he naturally assumed that the girl had thrown herself over. Everybody did to start with. Still, we've got the note, said Inspector Druitt. He turned to Sir Henry. Note in the dead girl's pocket, sir, written with a kind of artist's pencil it was, and all of a sop there the paper was, we managed to read it. And what did it say? It was from young Sanford. All right, that's how it ran. I'll meet you at the bridge at 8:30, R.S. Well, it was as near as might be to 8:30, a few minutes after, when Jimmy Brown heard the cry and the splash. I don't know whether you've met Sanford at all, went on Colonel Melchett. He's been down here about a month, one of those modern-day young architects who build peculiar houses, doing a house for Allington. God knows what it's going to be like. Full of new-fangled stuff, I suppose. Glass dinner table and surgical chairs made of steel and webbing. Well, that's neither here nor there, but it shows the kind of chap Sanford is. Bolshy, you know, no morals. Seduction, said Sir Henry mildly, is quite an old, established crime, though it does not, of course, date back so far as murder. Colonel Melchett stared. Oh, yes, he said, quite, quite. Well, Sir Henry, said Druitt, there it is. An ugly business, but plain. This young Sanford gets the girl into trouble, then he's all for clearing off back to London. He's got a girl there, a nice young lady, he's engaged to be married to her. Well, naturally, this business, if she gets to hear of it, may cook his goose good and proper. He meets Rose at the bridge, missed the evening, no one about. He catches her by the shoulders and pitches her in. Proper young swine, and deserves what's coming to him, that's my opinion. Sir Henry was silent for a minute or two. He perceived a strong undercurrent of local prejudice. A new-fangled architect was not likely to be popular in the conservative village of St. Mary Mead. There's no doubt, I suppose, that this man Sanford was actually the father of the coming child, he asked. He's the father, all right, said Druitt. Rose Emmett let out as much to her father. She thought he'd marry her. Marry her, not he. Dear me, thought Sir Henry, I seem to be back in mid-Victorian melodrama. Unsuspecting girl, the villain from London, the stern father, the betrayal. We only need the faithful village lover. Yes, I think it's time I asked about him. And aloud he said, hadn't the girl a young man of her own down here? You mean Joe Ellis, said the inspector. Good fellow, Joe. Carpentering's his trade. Ah, she's stuck to Joe. Colonel Melchett nodded approval. Stick to your own class, he snapped. How did Joe Ellis take this affair, asked Sir Henry. Nobody knew how he was taking it, said the inspector. He's a quiet fellow, is Joe. Close. Anything Rose did was right in his eyes. She had him on her string all right. Just hoped she'd come back to him some day. That was his attitude, I reckon. I'd like to see him, said Sir Henry. Oh, we're going to look him up, said Colonel Melchett. We're not neglecting any line. I thought myself we'd see Emmett first, then Sanford. And then we can go on and see Ellis. That suit you, Clithering? Sir Henry said it would suit him admirably. They found Tom Emmett at the Blue Boar. He was a big, burly man of middle age, with a shifty eye and truculent jaw. "Glad to see you, gentlemen. Good morning, Colonel. Come in here, we'll be private. Can I offer you anything, gentlemen? No? It's as you please. You've come about this business of my poor girl. Ah, she was a good girl, Rose was. Always was a good girl. Till this bloody swine, beg pardon, but that's what he is, till he came along. Promised her marriage, he did. But I'll have the law of him. Drove her to it, he did, murdering swine, bringing disgrace on all of us. My poor girl.
"'Your daughter distinctly told you that Mr. Stanford was responsible for her condition?' asked Melchett crisply. "'She did. In his very room she did.' "'And what did you say to her?' asked Sir Henry. "'Say to her?' The man seemed momentarily taken aback. "'Yes. You didn't, for example, threaten to turn her out of the house.' "'I was a bit upset. That's only natural. I'm sure you'll agree that's only natural, but... Of course I didn't turn her out of the house. I wouldn't do such a thing. He assumed virtuous indignation. No. What's the law for? That's what I say. What's the law for? He got to do the right thing by her, and if he didn't, by God, he's got to pay. He brought down his fist on the table. What time did you last see your daughter? Asked Melchett. Yesterday, tea time. What was her manner then? Well, much as usual, I didn't notice anything. If I'd known... But you didn't know, said the inspector dryly. They took their leave. Emmett hardly creates a favourable impression, said Sir Henry thoughtfully. Bit of a blackguard, said Melchett. He'd have bled Stanford all right if he'd had the chance. Their next call was on the architect. Rex Sanford was very unlike the picture Sir Henry had unconsciously formed of him. He was a tall young man, very fair and very thin. His eyes were blue and dreamy, his hair was untidy and rather too long. His speech was a little too ladylike. Colonel Melchett introduced himself and his companions. Then, passing straight to the object of his visit, he invited the architect to make a statement as to his movements on the previous evening. "'You understand,' he said warningly. "'I have no power to compel a statement from you, and any statement you make may be used in evidence against you. I want the position to be quite clear to you. I don't understand, said Sanford. You understand that the girl Rose Emmett was drowned last night? I know. Oh, it's too distressing, really. I haven't slept a wink. I've been incapable of any work today. I feel responsible, terribly responsible. He ran his hands through his hair, making it untidier still. I never meant any harm, he said piteously. I never dreamt she'd take it in that way. He sat down at a table and buried his face in his hands. "'Do I understand you to say, Mr. Sanford, that you refused to make a statement as to where you were last night at 8:30? "'No, no, no, certainly not. I was out. I went for a walk.' "'You went to meet Miss Emmett?' "'No, I went by myself through the woods, a long way.' "'Then how do you account for this note, sir, which was found in the dead girl's pocket?' And Inspector Druitt read it aloud, without emotion. "'Now, sir,' he finished. "'Do you deny that you wrote that?' No, you're right, I did write it. Rose asked me to meet her. She insisted. I didn't know what to do, so I wrote that note.' "'Ah, that's better,' said the inspector. "'But I didn't go!' Sanford's voice rose high and excited. "'I didn't go. I felt it would be much better not. I was returning to town tomorrow. I felt it would be much better not to meet. I intended to write from London and make some arrangement.' "'You're aware, sir, that this girl was going to have a child and that she had named you as its father?' Sanford groaned but didn't answer. "'Was that statement true, sir?' Sanford buried his face deeper. "'I suppose so,' he said in a muffled voice. "'Ah,' Inspector Druitt could not disguise his satisfaction. "'Now, about this walk of yours, is there anyone who saw you last night?' "'I don't know. I don't think so. "'As far as I can remember, I didn't meet anybody. "'That's a pity.' "'What do you mean?' Sanford stared wildly at him. "'What does it matter whether I was out for a walk or not? "'What difference does that make to Rose drowning herself?' "'Ah,' said the inspector, "'but you see, she didn't. "'She was thrown in deliberately, Mr. Sanford. "'She was—' "'It took him a minute or two to take in all the horror of it. "'My God! "'Then—' he dropped into a chair. "'Colonel Melchett made a move to depart. "'You understand, Sanford,' he said, "'you're on no account to leave this house.' "'The three men left together.' The inspector and the chief constable exchanged glances. "'That's enough, I think, sir,' said the inspector. "'Yes, get a warrant made out and arrest him.'
"Excuse me," said Sir Henry, "I've forgotten my gloves." He re-entered the house rapidly. Sanford was sitting just as they left him, staring dazedly in front of him. "I have come back," said Sir Henry, "to tell you that I, personally, am anxious to do all I can to assist you. The motive of my interest in you I am not at liberty to reveal, but I am going to ask you, if you will, to tell me as briefly as possible exactly what passed between you and this girl Rose."
She was very pretty," said Sanford, "very pretty and very alluring, and she made a dead set for me. Oh, before God, that's true. She wouldn't let me alone. And it was lonely down here, and nobody liked me much, and as I say, she was amazingly pretty, and she seemed to know her way about, and all that." His voice died away. He looked up. "And then this happened. She wanted me to marry her. I didn't know what to do. I'm engaged to a girl in London. Oh, she ever gets to hear of this, and she will, of course. Well, it's all up. She won't understand. How could she? And I am a rotter, of course. As I say, I didn't know what to do. I avoided seeing Rose again. I thought I'd get back to town, see my lawyer, make arrangements about money and so forth for her. Oh, God, what a fool I've been. And it's all so clear, the case against me. But they've made a mistake. She must have done it herself."
"Did she ever threaten to take her life?" Sanford shook his head.
"Never. I shouldn't have said she was that sort."
"What about a man called Joe Ellis?"
"The carpenter fellow, good old village stock. Dull fellow, but crazy about Rose."
"He might have been jealous," suggested Sir Henry.
"I suppose he was a bit, but he's a bovine kind. He'd suffer in silence."
"Well," said Sir Henry, "I must be going." He rejoined the others. "You know, Melchett," he said, "I feel we ought to have a look at this other fellow, Ellis, before we do anything drastic. Pity if you made an arrest that turned out to be a mistake. After all, jealousy is a pretty good motive for murder. Pretty common one, too." "That's true enough," said the inspector, "but Joe Ellis isn't that kind. Wouldn't hurt a fly. Why, nobody's ever seen him out of temper. Still, I agree we'd better just ask him where he was last night. She'll be at home now. He lodges with Mrs. Bartlett, very decent soul, a widow, takes in a bit of washing." The little cottage to which they bent their footsteps was spotlessly clean and neat. A big, stout woman of middle age opened the door to them. She had a pleasant face and blue eyes. "Good morning, Mrs. Bartlett," said the inspector. "Is Joe Ellis here?" "Came back not 10 minutes ago," said Mrs. Bartlett. "Step inside, will you please, sirs?" Wiping her hands on her apron, she led them into a tiny front parlour with stuffed birds, china dogs, a sofa, and several useless pieces of furniture. She hurriedly arranged seats for them, picked up a whatnot bodily to make further room, and went out calling, "Joe, there's three gentlemen want to see you." A voice from the back kitchen replied, "I'll be there when I've cleaned myself." Mrs. Bartlett smiled. "Come in, Mrs. Bartlett," said Colonel Milchiff. "Sit down." "Oh, no, sir, I couldn't think of it." Mrs. Bartlett was shocked at the idea. "You find Joe Ellis a good lodger?" inquired Milchett in a seemingly careless tone. "Couldn't have a better, sir. Real steady young fellow, never touches a drop of drink, takes a pride in his work, and always kind and helpful about the house. He put up those shelves for me, and he's fixed a new dresser in the kitchen. And any little thing that wants doing in the house, why, Joe does it as a matter of course, and won't hardly take thanks for it. Ah, there aren't many young fellows like Joe, sir." "Some girl'll be luckier some day," said Milchett carelessly. "He was rather sweet on that poor girl, Rose Emmett, wasn't he?" Mrs. Bartlett sighed. "Made me tired, it did, him worshipping the ground she trod on and her not caring a snap of the fingers for him." "Where does Joe spend his evenings, Mrs. Bartlett?" "Here, sir, usually. Does some odd piece of work in the evening sometimes, and he's trying to learn bookkeeping by correspondence." "Ah, really? Was he in yesterday evening?" "Yes, sir." "You're sure, Mrs. Bartlett?" said Sir Henry sharply. She turned to him. "Quite sure, sir. He didn't go out, for instance, somewhere about 8 to 8:30. "Oh, no," Mrs. Bartlett laughed. "He was fixing the kitchen dresser for me nearly all the evening, and I was helping him." Sir Henry looked at her smiling, assured face,
and felt his first pang of doubt. A moment later, Ellis himself entered the room. He was a tall, broad-shouldered young man, very good-looking in a rustic way. He had shy blue eyes and a good-tempered smile. Altogether an amiable young giant. Milchett opened the conversation. Mrs. Bartlett withdrew to the kitchen. "We're investigating the death of Rose Emmett. You knew her, Ellis?" "Yes," he hesitated and then muttered. "Hope to marry her one day, poor lass." "You've heard what her condition was?" "Yes," a spark of anger showed in his eye. "Let her down, he did, but to her for the best. She wouldn't have been happy married to him. I reckon she'd come to me when this happened. I'd have looked after her." "In spite of—" "'Twan't her fault. He led her astray, with fine promises and all. Oh, she told me all about it. She'd no call to drown herself. It weren't worth it." "Where were you, Ellis, last night at 8:30? Was it Sir Henry's fancy, or was there really a shade of constraint in the ready, almost too ready, reply? "I was here, fixing up a contraption in the kitchen for Mrs. B. You ask her, she'll tell you." He was too quick with that, thought Sir Henry. He's a slow-thinking man. That popped out so pat. I suspect he'd got it ready beforehand. Then he told himself that it was imagination. He was imagining things. Yes, even imagining an apprehensive glint in those blue eyes. A few more questions and answers, and they left. Sir Henry made an excuse to go to the kitchen. Mrs. Bartlett was busy at the stove. She looked up with a pleasant smile. A new dresser was fixed against the wall. It was not quite finished. Some tools lay about and some pieces of wood. "That's what Ellis was at work on last night," said Sir Henry. "Yes, sir. Nice bit of work, isn't it? He's a very clever carpenter, Joe is." No apprehensive gleam in her eye, no embarrassment. But Ellis, had he imagined it? No, there had been something. "I must tackle him," thought Sir Henry. Turning to leave the kitchen, he collided with a perambulator. "Not woken the baby up, I hope," he said. Mrs. Bartlett's laugh rang out. "Oh, no, sir! I've no children, more's the pity. That's what I take the laundry on, sir." "Oh, I see." He paused and said on an impulse, "Mrs. Bartlett, you knew Rose Emmett. Tell me what you really thought of her." She looked at him curiously. "Well, sir, I thought she was flighty. But she's dead, and I don't like to speak ill of the dead. But I have a reason, a very good reason for asking." He spoke persuasively. She seemed to consider, studying him attentively. Finally, she made up her mind. "She was a bad lot, sir," she said quietly. "I wouldn't say so before Joe. She took him in good and proper. That kind can. More's a pity. You know how it is, sir." Yes, Sir Henry knew. The Joe Ellises of the world were peculiarly vulnerable. They trusted blindly. But for that very cause, the shock of discovery might be greater. He left the cottage baffled and perplexed. He was up against a blank wall. Joe Ellis had been working indoors all yesterday evening. Mrs. Bartlett had actually been there watching him. Could one possibly get round that? There was nothing to set against it, except possibly that suspicious readiness in replying on Joe Ellis's part, that suggestion of having a story, pat. "Well," said Melchett, "that seems to make the matter quite clear, eh?" "Does, sir," agreed the inspector. "Sanford's our man, not a leg to stand upon. Things as plain as daylight. My opinion is the girl and her father were out to, well, practically blackmail him. He's no money to speak of. He didn't want the matter to get to his young lady's ears. He was desperate, and he acted accordingly. What do you say, sir?" he added, addressing Sir Henry deferentially. "Seems so," admitted Sir Henry, "and yet I can hardly picture Sanford committing any violent action." But he knew as he spoke that the objection was hardly valid. The meekest animal, when cornered, is capable of amazing actions. "I should like to see the boy, though," he said suddenly, "the one who heard the cry." Jimmy Brown proved to be an intelligent lad, rather small for his age, with a sharp, rather cunning face. He was eager to be questioned and was rather disappointed when checked in his dramatic tale of what he had heard on the fatal night.
"You were on the other side of the bridge, I understand," said Sir Henry, "across the river from the village. Did you see anyone on that side as you came up over the bridge?"
"There was someone walking up in the woods, Mr. Sanford, I think it was, the architect gentleman who's building the queer house."
The three men exchanged glances.
"That was about 10 minutes or so before you heard the cry."
The boy nodded.
"Did you see anyone else on the village side of the river?"
"A man came along the path that side, going slow, and whistling he was. Might have been Joe Ellis."
"You couldn't possibly have seen who it was," said the inspector sharply, "what with the mist and its being dusk."
"It's on account of the whistle," said the boy. "Joe Ellis always whistles the same tune. I want to be happy. It's the only tune he knows."
He spoke with the scorn of the modernist for the old-fashioned. "Anyone might whistle a tune," said Melchett. "Was he going towards the bridge?"
"No, other way, to village."
"I don't think we need concern ourselves with this unknown man," said Melchett. "You heard the cry and the splash, and a few minutes later you saw the body floating downstream, and you ran for help, going back to the bridge, crossing it, and making straight for the village. You didn't see anyone near the bridge as you ran for help?"
"I think as there were two men with a wheelbarrow on the river path, but they were some ways away, and I couldn't tell if they were coming or going, and Mr. Giles' place was nearest, so I ran there."
"You did well, my boy," said Melchett. "You acted very creditably and with presence of mind. You're a scout, aren't you?"
"Yes, sir."
"Very good, very good indeed."
Sir Henry was silent, thinking. He took a slip of paper from his pocket, looked at it, shook his head. It didn't seem possible. And yet,
he decided to pay a call on Miss Marple. She received him in her pretty, slightly overcrowded old-style drawing-room. "I've come to report progress," said Sir Henry. "I'm afraid that from our point of view things aren't going well. They're going to arrest Sanford, and I must say I think they're justified."
"You found nothing in, what shall I say, support of my theory, then?" She looked perplexed, anxious. "Perhaps I've been wrong, quite wrong. You have such a wide experience. You would surely detect if it were so."
"For one thing," said Sir Henry, "I can hardly believe it. And for another, we're up against an unbreakable alibi. Joe Ellis was fixing shelves in the kitchen all the evening, and Mrs. Bartlett was watching him do it."
Miss Marple leant forward, taking in a quick breath. "Oh, but that can't be so," she said. "It was Friday night."
"Friday night?"
"Yes, Friday night. On Friday evenings, Mrs. Bartlett takes the laundry she has done round to the different people."
Sir Henry leant back in his chair. He remembered the boy Jimmy's story of the whistling man, and, yes, it would all fit in. He rose, taking Miss Marple warmly by the hand. "I think I see my way," he said. "Least I can try." 5 minutes later he was back at Mrs. Bartlett's cottage and facing Joe Ellis in the little parlour among the china dogs. "You lied to us, Ellis, about last night," he said crisply. "You were not in the kitchen here fixing the dresser between 8 and 8:30. You were seen walking along the path by the river towards the bridge a few minutes before Rose Emmett was murdered."
The man gasped.
"She weren't murdered. She weren't. I ought to do with it. She threw herself in. She did. She was desperate-like. I wouldn't have harmed a hair on her head, I wouldn't."
"Then why did you lie as to where you were?" asked Sir Henry keenly. The man's eyes shifted and lowered uncomfortably.
"I was scared. Mrs. B. saw me around there, and when we heard just afterwards what had happened, well, she thought it might look bad for me. I fixed I'd say I was working here, and she agreed to back me up. She's a rare one, she is. She's always been good to me."
Without a word, Sir Henry left the room and walked into the kitchen. Mrs. Bartlett was washing up at the sink.
"Mrs. Bartlett," he said, "I know everything. I think you'd better confess. That is, unless you want Joe Ellis hanged for something he didn't do."
"No, I see you don't want that. I'll tell you what happened. You were out taking the laundry home. You came across Rose Emmett. You thought she'd given Joe the chuck and was taking up with this stranger. Now she was in trouble. Joe was prepared to come to the rescue, marry her if need be, and if she'd have him. He's lived in your house for 4 years.
You've fallen in love with him. You want him for yourself.
You hated this girl. You couldn't bear that this worthless little slut should take your man from you. You're a strong woman, Mrs. Bartlett. You caught the girl by the shoulders and shoved her over into the stream. A few minutes later, you met Joe Ellis. The boy Jimmy saw you together in the distance. But in the darkness and the mist, he assumed the perambulator was a wheelbarrow and two men wheeling it. You persuaded Joe that he might be suspected, and you concocted what was supposed to be an alibi for him, but which was really an alibi for you. Now then, I'm right, am I not? He held his breath. He had staked all on this throw. She stood before him, rubbing her hands on her apron, slowly making up her mind. It's just as you say, sir, she said at last in her quiet, subdued voice. A dangerous voice, Sir Henry suddenly felt it to be. I don't know what came over me. Shameless. That's what she was. It just came over me. She shan't take Joe from me. I haven't had a happy life, sir. My husband, he was a poor lot, an invalid and cross-grained. I nursed and looked after him, true. And then Joe came here to lodge. I'm not such an old woman, sir, in spite of my grey hair. I'm just 40, sir. Joe's one in 1,000. I'd have done anything for him, anything at all. He was like a little child, sir, so gentle and so believing. He was mine, sir, to look after and see to, and this... She swallowed, checked her emotion. Even at this moment she was a strong woman. She stood up straight and looked at Sir Henry curiously. I'm ready to come, sir. I never thought anyone would find out. I don't know how you knew, sir. I don't, I'm sure. Sir Henry shook his head gently. It was not I who knew, he said. And he thought of the piece of paper still reposing in his pocket, with the words on it written in neat, old-fashioned handwriting. Mrs. Bartlett, with whom Joe Ellis lodges, at 2 Mill Cottages. Miss Marple had been right again.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.